listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Wednesday will mark 53 years since Malcolm X was assassinated in New York City. Today, we mark that anniversary with this debate between Malcolm X and James Baldwin, recorded September 5th, 1963.
First, I would like to say that I'm speaking not for myself, but as a follower and helper and representative of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who is the spiritual head of the fastest growing group, religious group, of black people here in the Western Hemisphere. When we give our views, we don't give them as a civic group, we don't give them as a political group, but we give them primarily as a religious group. And any solution that we support, we absolutely feel that it's a religious solution rather than a political solution. One of the reasons that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, in teaching us here in America, is giving us a solution that differs drastically from the sit-in movement. He's trying to make us men. Now, the very fact that you find students all over the world today are standing up for their rights and fighting for their rights. But here in America, the so-called Negro students have allowed themselves to be maneuvered under a tag of sit-in. It actually, I guess it describes it. The name describes its nature, that it's a passive thing. And if their goal is integration, it's not a worthwhile one, but if their goal is freedom, justice, and equality, then that's a worthwhile goal. If integration is going to give the black people in America complete freedom, complete justice, and complete equality, then it's a worthwhile goal. The holding this integration bottle and dangling it in front of the Negroes in America today has actually disabled them or it has nullified their ability to stand up and fight like a man for something that is theirs by right, rather than to just sit around and beg and wait for the white man to make up his mind that they're worthy to have this type thing. I think that this is, in my opinion, why we disagree with the sit-in movement. If they are willing to wait for another 100 years for the white man to change his mind to accept them as a human being, then they're wrong. But if they're willing to lay down their life tonight or in the morning in order that we can have what is ours by right tonight or in the morning, then it's a good movement. But as long as they're willing to wait for the white man to make up his mind that they are qualified to be respected as human beings, then I'm afraid that all of their waiting and their planning is for naught. As Thurgood Marshall said on New Year's Eve, the Supreme Court brought about the desegregation decision, I think, 6 or 7 years ago, and there is only 6% desegregation in America right now. We don't call two students, black students, going to the University of Georgia integration, nor do we call four children, black children, going to school in New Orleans integration, nor do we call a handful of black students going to school in Little Rock integration. If every black man in the state of Arkansas can't go to any school he wants, that's not integration. And if every black child in the state of Louisiana cannot go to any school that they are qualified for in the morning, then that's not integration. And likewise with Georgia and any other state in America. It's no integration with us until the entire thing is laid on the table, not 100 years from now, but in the morning. And at the rate that the NAACP, CORE, and the Urban League is willing to accept the change of attitude in the white man's mind, we who are Muslims feel we'll be sitting around here in America for another 1,000 years, not waiting for civil rights or something like that, but even waiting to be granted the rights of a human being.
I have a feeling that a great many words have been floating around this table, which need to be redefined. And that, by the way, is the problem I think which facing this entire country. Now, I don't agree with Mr. X about the sit-in movement, and I do know something about the war, the incipient war between the students and some of the leaders. I know the gap, the enormous gap between the NAACP and the children in the South. I don't agree that the sit-in, you know, I don't agree that it is necessarily passive. I think it demands a tremendous amount of power in one's personal life and in terms of political or polemical activity, sometimes to sit down and do nothing or seem to do nothing. But finally, when the sit-in movement started, or when a great many things started in the Western world, it was not, I think it had a great deal less to do with equality than it had to do with power. And I do think we have to decide what we want, you know. Now, what has happened in the world in relation to black people is not the white people have suddenly changed or become more conscious of a black man's humanity. It is, what has happened is very simple. This is the white collar has been broken, and this means, among other things, that it is no longer possible for an Englishman to describe an African and make the African believe it. It is no longer possible for a white man in this country to tell a Negro who he is and make the Negro believe this. The controlling image is absolutely gone. Now, it seems to me the responsibility which faces us then, the question which faces us, which faces me in any case, is since there is a distinction between power and equality, there is a distinction between power and freedom, and I know that in terms, for example, of Africa, that an African nation cannot expect to be respected unless it is free, I know that unless it has its political destiny in its own hands, which is what we mean by power, there is no hope that the English will deal with an African nation as a subjugated nation as long as it is in fact subjugated. That is not quite the same situation that we face here in America as American Negroes. I can see that I might very well, for one reason or another, leave this country tomorrow and never come back. But this will not make me, this will not cease, I will not cease to be an American Negro for this reason. And the history of our history in this country is something that I think we have to face, especially since we're demanding that white people face it. And whether I like it or not, whether you like it or not, this issue about integration is a false issue, because we have been integrated here ever since we got here. I am no longer a pure African. There are no pure Africans in this country. The history which has produced us is something which, in any case, we're going to have to deal with one of these days. Now, I think it is a mistake to pretend this issue did not happen. What we're arguing about, I think, one of the things, in any case, I think I would be arguing about, is the effect of this on the Negro world and the great divisions in it, so that it does in fact range from people who imagine they are white, you know, who never talk to Negroes, to people who imagine that if they can make a buck, they will somehow beat the system, to homeless and demoralized black boys and girls who have don't know where to go. The issue, it seems to me, the reason that the civil movement is important, the reason this whole ferment is of such importance, is not that I want anybody's cup of coffee, or even to go, particularly to anybody's school. It is because the country cannot afford to have, as it has at this moment, millions of black boys and girls in various ghettos all over the country, either perishing literally, or perishing, I must say, finally, with the kind of demoralization and bitterness and hatred, which can, after all, blow this country wide apart. The importance, in my mind, of the Muslim movement, in conclusion, is that it is the first time, I think, in the history of this country, that a Negro audience, a Negro laborer, a Negro schoolboy, has heard his own condition described without anybody trying to flinch from it. It is very different hearing a speech by Roy Wilkins, in which, you know, one is told, in one way or another, that tomorrow will be better. And I think this has a tremendous effect. This is the reason I think the Muslim speaker has so much power over his audience. It comes out of a failure in the Republic. This country has lied about the Negro situation for 100 years. And now what has happened is the lies are no longer viable, can no longer be accepted even when they make it told. And the country has waited so long and it does not know how to handle this. And it's created a moral vacuum. There's a moral vacuum in the Negro ghettos in the same way there's a moral vacuum in New Orleans, which is filled with desperate people. Now, I don't think that we can afford this. It seems to me, and now I speak for myself, my quarrel with the official Negro leadership, and my quarrel with those such Negroes as imagine they are integrated or imagine they somehow escaped the Negro condition, is that they are not willing to do what I think is absolutely essential. One has got to re-examine the basis, the standards of this country, which not only afflict black people, they afflict the entire country. No one in this country, as far as I can see, really knows any longer what it means to be an American. He does not know what he means by freedom. He does not know what he means by equality. We live in the most abysmal ignorance of not only the condition of 20 million Negroes in our midst, but the whole nature of the life being lived in the rest of the world. And I think that the American white man, the Republic, is beginning to pay for his treatment of the Negro in terms of what he does not know about the rest of the world. You cannot live, it seems to me, you cannot live 30 years, let's say, with something in your closet which you know is there and pretend it is not there without something terrible happening to you. By and by, I cannot say, if I know that any one of you, you know, has murdered your brother, your mother, and the corpse is in this room and under the table, and I know it, and you know it, and you know I know it, and we cannot talk about it. It takes no time at all before we cannot talk about anything, before absolute silence descends. And that kind of silence is descending on this country. I think that this country has become almost inconceivably radical. It has really got to do something that it's not done before, and this involves the humanity of everybody in it. And the key to this is in the Negro. If one can face that, one can face anything, but that has not been faced. I think this is the reason for the confusion and the ferment and the great, great danger. Again, let me say this, and I will stop. I'm not religious. And therefore, since I'm not religious, all theologies, for me, are suspect. All theologies have a certain use. But I never, for example, believed in the myth of the virgin birth. I never quite understood why it was necessary to propagate such a peculiar notion. Therefore, you know, as theologies go, it seems to me the Muslim theology is just as good as any. One cannot quarrel with it there. I can't, anyway. But I personally reject that theology as I reject all others. And I don't think that we need it. Now, this is a gamble. This is a very reckless thing to say. And perhaps, you know, perhaps it's very mystical. I know the kind of world I would like to see. I would like to think of myself, is not needing to be supported by a myth. I would like to see myself as being able to face whatever it is I have to face as me, dealing with what I have and what there is, without having my identity dependent on something which finally has to be believed, which cannot be tested. This is why one is converted to a religion, you know. I think that there's something very dangerous in it. What I would like to see, and maybe we'll never live to see it, is a world in which these things are not necessary, which I will not need to invent, in effect, a heritage and a history that can deal with the one I have, and will not need, in order to deal with the rest of the world, will not need to feel superior to them, but simply be a part of them. And it seems to me this may happen. Well, I love to see a world in which there are no blacks, there are no whites, where it does not matter. Because as long as it does matter, as long as it does matter, and it doesn't matter who is wearing a shoe, the confusion will be great and the bloodshed will be great.
Well, I, as a black man, and proud of being a black man, I can't conceive of myself as having any desire whatsoever to lose my identity. I wouldn't want to live in a world where none of my kind existed. I do think that the Negro, American so-called Negro, is the only person on earth who would be willing to lose his identity in a, what you might call a new product. I heard one fellow say one day that there eventually intermarriage and intermixing would take place on such a vast scale that it would produce a chocolate-colored race. And Martin Luther King was in a discussion, televised discussion, with a white newspaper man. I saw it on the television a couple months ago. And this white newspaper man put this to him. He pointed out that he's proud of his white race. He's proud of what he is. He's proud of his racial characteristics to the extent where he has no desire to lose it by mixing with any other race. And the thing that he said he couldn't understand was why the so-called Negroes don't have the same racial pride that whites have in trying to retain their characteristics. And Martin Luther King never answered him, although he should have answered him. I think that it is disastrous for the black people in America to reach the point where their racial pride disappears, and they don't care whether their blood is mixed up with someone else's. I think that also one of the things that brings this about, as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us, the very fact that you have to refer to the black man in America as a Negro shows you that right there something is wrong. An African doesn't accept this term Negro, and you find they teach us in the educational system of this country that Negro is a Spanish word that's supposed to mean black, yet when you find the black people who live in Spanish-speaking countries of South and Central America, they don't accept the word Negro to identify themselves. No one allows himself to be classified under the word Negro but the black man here in America who is a descendant of the slaves. And very seldom is it ever applied to anybody but the black man in here in America who is the descendant of the slaves. When you ask a man his identity, he should use a word that connects him with a culture. If you ask him his nationality, it should connect him with a nation. Like if I ask a man his nationality and he says German, that connects him with Germany. Or if he says, even if he says German-American, it still connects him with having originated, his family, his history, has originated in Germany. If he says he's French-American, it connects him with France. But when you ask the black man in America, and he tells you Negro, he doesn't put any other country in front. He puts American Negro, or he'll just say Negro. This doesn't identify him. And usually when you find a man who calls himself a Negro, he can't tell you what language that he spoke before he came to this country. It's of no consequence, no interest. He believes that prior to coming here, he was a savage in the jungle, and therefore he had no language. And this justifies his lack of knowledge concerning that mother tongue today. And the history, as Mr. Baldwin pointed out, of the white man here in America and the black man here in America, points up the fact that the Negro, or the man here who calls himself a Negro, is just an ex-slave. If he is an ex-slave, I'd rather say he's still a slave. but he's wearing his slave master's name, the name that was given to him during slavery. He's speaking the language of the man who made him a slave because he has no knowledge of his own tongue. He only knows the history, his own history, as taught to him by his former slave master, who purposely hid from him his own history to make him think that he was an inferior being before being brought here. And Mr. Muhammad teaches us that until the black man here in America is connected or reestablished or given some knowledge of his existence prior to coming here to America, his own appraisal of himself will be so low that he'll actually think that the white man is doing him a favor to let him be here in America no matter what his status is. And he also, and this is one of the reasons today why he fights so hard, some of them, to sit down next to the white man. They actually think that the white man is the personification of perfection, and whenever they're allowed to go live in his neighborhood or sit in his restaurant or mingle or socialize with him, that they have attained, that they have made progress. But when they go back and study the history of their own people and the accomplishments of their own people, the civilizations and cultures, black civilizations and black cultures that existed in Africa at a time when the whites in Europe were living a cave-like existence, then immediately their appraisal of their self, of themselves begins to go higher. And they don't think that to beg somebody to mingle with them in this country is any kind of progress whatsoever. And I would like to say one more thing, too, on that nonviolent thing, that the black man in America is the only one who is encouraged to be nonviolent, or the black man in Africa, or the black man in Asia. Never do you find white people encouraging other whites to be nonviolent. Whites idolize fighters. They idolize the Hungarian freedom fighters who came to this country and right now can work on jobs that the sit-in students can't get, can live in neighborhoods that the sit-in students can't live in, and can go into public places that the student sit-ins can't go, because they are fighters. Everyone loves a fighter. They respect the fighter. But at the same time that they admire these fighters, they encourage the so-called Negro in America to get his desires fulfilled with a sit-in stroke or a passive approach or a love-your-enemy approach or pray for those who despitefully use you. This is insane. And we feel as Muslims, until we see white people practicing this nonviolence, take Pearl Harbor. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the American white man didn't say, pray for the Japanese and let them now bomb Manhattan or Staten Island. No, they said, praise the Lord, but pass the ammunition. And if anybody comes along, like Mr. Muhammad, and begins to point out uncompromisingly in blunt terms that don't need diplomatic language that can be misinterpreted, and he begins to point out these atrocities and crimes that have been committed against black people here in America today, the white man can never deny the fact that he's guilty, but he'll always say, well, forget the past and let's look forward. But the only people who are told to forget the injustices that have been done to them are the black people. But when it comes to whites, right today, you can turn on any radio, turn on any television, read any newspaper, and the Jews have magnified to the world the crimes that were committed against them 20 years ago or so by Eichmann, and they keep you sitting on the edge of your seat wanting to strangle Eichmann. It's almost like a Hate Germany campaign, but yet the Jews are never accused of teaching hate, because they remind the world of the crimes that were committed against them. But when the black man here in America begins to stand up and speak about the crimes that are committed against him throughout America every day, no let up, just different forms, immediately a black man who dwells on that is considered a racist, considered an extremist, or considered someone who is advocating a doctrine that'll bring about violence and bring about a deterioration in the so-called good relations that are supposed to be developing between black and white in this country. So we just can't go along with any of that. And I think that this is the thing that the white people of America should realize, that Mr. Muhammad's teaching, and it's spreading, so you have to deal with it. Mr. Muhammad's teaching doesn't teach the black man to wait for the white man to change his mind. Mr. Muhammad's teaching is changing the black man's appraisal of himself. And as soon as the black man undergoes a reappraisal of himself and realizes that he's a man too, he says to himself, why should he wait for the Supreme Court
to give him what a white man has when he's born? Why should he wait for the Congress or the Senate or the President to tell him that he should have this, when if he's a man the same as that man is a man, he doesn't need any President, he doesn't need any Congress, he doesn't need any Supreme Court, he doesn't need anybody but himself to bring about that which is his if he is a man?
I think in the first place there's some disagreement between Mr. Malcolm X and myself as to what this heritage is. And I want to go back to that in a minute. Something else at the moment bothers me. I think there's not much clarity in this question of violence. From my point of view, from where I sit, whether or not, no matter what Mr. X wants, no matter what I want, I believe, for example, that one of these days, maybe tomorrow, Birmingham, Alabama will probably blow up. And if Birmingham blows up, it will not just stretch to Atlanta, it will stretch to Boston. There's a kind of fuse. There's an undercurrent. There's something which unites all the Negroes in this country, so that what happens in Birmingham can blow up Harlem. It has happened before. And unless we are extremely swift and miraculously swift, it will happen again. I take violence as given. I think it is coming in any case. What exercises my mind is what happens then. In the first place, this country, in this position in the world now, this extremely precarious position in the world now, the situation of the Negro here is different from that of the Jews in Germany, let us say, 20 or 30 years ago, in that if Birmingham should blow up, if they should really erupt in America this week, real racial violence, it would have repercussions all over the world. I'm afraid we have to face this fact, that when the Jews were being slaughtered in Germany in the very beginning, no one seemed to care. Millions of Jews crossed the world, and boatloads of them, and no country would let them in. But the American Negro has something working for him in this context, or the country has something working against it, which I don't think he can afford. But I want to get back to this question of identity, because it seems to me this is where all the questions are. Mr. Malcolm X disagrees with the word Negro, and I can see his point. I confess it doesn't at the moment much interest me, but that may be my fault. What I am concerned about, though, is the actual history of Negroes in this country. I think one has got to face the fact that it has been one of the ugliest histories in the history of the West. But as one can face this fact, there is another fact which I think one has got to face, which is also one of the most remarkable histories that we know of. And I'm not talking about all the good things that white people did, for the poor darkies and all that jazz. I'm talking about the effect of this experience on the people who underwent it, the masters and the slaves, what it did to them. I would be a very different person if I were not the descendant of a slave. In fact, I am the descendant of a slave. This is one of the things I have to deal with because it is true. And I don't think that it has to be a badge of shame. Negroes are not the only slaves. We are not the only descendants of slaves. I can't eliminate one half of my ancestors. My grandmother was raped, let us say. This is a fact I have to face. This means that I'm no longer a pure African, and that my relationship to white people is not that of a Congolese to Belgium, and cannot be, no matter how hard I try to make it that. My relationship to white people is dictated by my mother's relationship to them, my father's, by the fact that my grandmother nursed children who grew up to lynch her children, that my father's fathers were always under the heel of some benevolent white man, and the whole myth of this experience has come into being in the country, which is at its highest seen in Faulkner and at its lowest seen in Margaret Mitchell. Now, I don't think that we can be liberated from this history until we are willing to deal with it, and this means that I have to deal with it as well as any white man in the country has to deal with it. There's really too much and too little to say. What is the issue here? Malcolm X wants us to act like men, and it seems to me, one of the things that I object to here, I don't think that the fact that white people have done what they have done, Patrick Henry is not one of my heroes. I'm sorry. Most of the American heroes have never been in my Hall of Fame. I don't see any reason for me, at this late date, to begin modeling myself on an image which I've always found, frankly, to be mediocre and not a standard to which I myself could repair. I don't think that black men now should be, because white men have committed these crimes, that black men should do the same thing. I think that there is something absolutely insidious even if I cannot make this absolutely clear, there's something, to my mind, always terribly insidious in the whole question of race. The white man's racial characteristics, of which the white man claims to be so proud, have reduced him in this country to incredible levels. There is nobody in the world, I think, sadder than a white man in the deep South who only has his skin and his blue eyes and his yellow hair and nothing else. I don't think that I want to go through the world, and I will not encourage my nephew to begin to go through the world only armed with the color of his skin. The only thing that really arms anybody when the chips are down is how closely, how thoroughly he can relate to himself and deal with the world, yes, as a man, you know. But I don't think, when I talk about standards, I say they're all going to be revised. It's one of the standards that has to be revised. I don't think that a warrior is necessarily a man. And in fact, it has been proven that football players and all these people in teams and in armies are not men. It is very difficult to be a man. And what it involves, for me, anyway, is an ability to look at the world, to look at whatever it is, and to say what it is and deal with it, to face it, even if it does mean laying down your life, because in a way it always does mean that.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Is the day of reckoning coming? Will the liberal corporate media ever own up to their dismal and even dishonest coverage of what is called Russiagate? There is growing evidence the media are at the very center of this fake scandal. Crosstalking the fake news media, I'm joined by my guest, Charles Ortel in New York. He is a private investor and writer, as well as the host of a podcast show, Sunday with Charles. Also in New York, we have Don DeBar. He's an anti-war activist and host of a daily radio program. And in London, we have Adam Gari. He is the director of Eurasia Future. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want. Let me go to Adam first in London. Adam, if I didn't know better, watching the cable network news, I would have thought that it is a Netflix series, a very bad series that should have been canceled probably after its pilot. But no, it goes on and on and on and has no reflection to reality. Let's take, for example, the indictment of 13 Russians. I looked at CNN and MSNBC. I didn't have any indication whatsoever they actually read the indictment. And all they do is go on and on and on. We have Matthew Chance from CNN in St. Petersburg, Russia, going through the trash, the garbage of that troll farm. That's, well, I guess trash meets trash. Go ahead, Adam.
Well, that really is truly a marriage made in heaven, and it's symptomatic of the image, of a kind of stereotypical image of what the mainstream media is doing. The very sad part, and there is a tragedy buried within the lies which themselves are wrapped up in a farce, and that is that these people who are peddling the Russiagate myth have failed to even acknowledge that the United States is no longer a democracy, and I'm sad about that. I take no joy in saying it. Instead, it's a kleptocracy which itself is supervised by an oligarchy. This oligarchy is made up of the military industrial complex, foreign intelligence agencies, the corporatocracy, and this collective thing that we all know and not so much love as the deep state. If they were truly concerned about democracy in the United States, they talk about how to reform it to even get it back to a level where it is actually something that resembles rule of the people, where the people are listened to. The people are being totally ignored, and the only thing they talk about is Russia. Russia didn't rig a system that itself is rigged in an airtight manner.
Yep, okay. Charles, let me go to you, because if you take your time and you look at it logically without bias, and, you know, we can just take one major piece of this fake story, that fake dossier by Christopher Steele. But if you look at the timelines of all of the quote-unquote leaks, because they're intentional, is that you have all these mainstream outlets having knowledge or some knowledge of the dossier, and they dribble it out. Because they all thought because they're all liberal outlets, that Hillary was going to win anyway. So nobody was going to be held accountable for it. I could go through the outlets here, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Yahoo News, the New Yorker, CNN, Mother Jones, Reuters, BBC. I can go on and on. And, you know, this was an open secret. This is a scandal created by the media, and then it just bounce around their own echo chamber. Go ahead, Charles.
I totally agree. I mean, we could go back before the Obama years, but let's start with the Obama years. And to understand the scandal in context, we have to ask the question, who authorized Hillary Clinton to monetize the State Department through her foundation using private servers and unsecure devices starting January 21st, 2009? I mean, and how come the media didn't look into any of that? And I think the answer is the media was captured, certainly under the Obama years, by people who wanted to stay on the right side of the Obama team, wanted Obama to be reelected, saw the virtues in Hillary ultimately becoming president so they could carry on the same game. This scandal is a classic example of gaslighting, with the Clinton team and the Obama team in support and the media in support accusing the right wing and the Trump administration of the very things they were doing in spades, which is from July 10th, 2015, it is in the public record, the FBI had opened an investigation into Hillary Clinton's misuse of classified information. We won't yet see, the public hasn't yet seen the Inspector General report. When that report comes out, I expect it will be explosive. It's going to be a lot bigger than, you know, $500 worth of Facebook ads in some Midwestern state. This is all about mishandling of classified information, potentially for the economic benefit of supporters of the Democratic Party in the deep state, and possibly even into the zone of treason. That's a real scandal, and the mainstream media has discredited itself in this country and around the world, in my view.
You know, Don, you know, the interesting thing for me is that when Rod Rosenstein, of all people, to be honest with you, was reading out that indictment, I mean, he needs to get in front of a grand jury. I mean, seriously. And he's reading it out. I mean, that's a classic example of taking out the garbage on Friday that changed the topic here. Oh, because, by the way, I think Mueller and his team, they're all paid by the hour. How many more hours are they going to be paid? I mean, they're going to be able to retire on this and support their grandchildren on this. Okay, but Don, you know, let's go back to the 13 indictments. I mean, when I saw it, Rosenstein's, I saw it on YouTube, I read the indictment, and the first question that came to my mind, well, where is Christopher Steele's name? He wasn't registered as a foreign agent. He didn't register with the Federal Elections Commission. I mean, everything they accused these young kids, they were basically interns at this troll farm, applies to Christopher Steele. But and the mainstream media, the cable crazy people, didn't even one of them, they're legal experts, didn't even draw that conclusion. That was the first conclusion I came to. Go ahead, Don.
Well, first of all, you have to look at what exactly this indictment is coming from a grand jury and what the grand jury process is. You know, famously, it's been described as a process where a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich.
Yeah.
This was a term that was coined by the former head of the state court system here in New York, who himself ended up getting indicted on his way out of his career. And this is a process that took place, a grand jury came out of the grand jury pool. It was in Washington, D.C. District Court, District of Columbia District Court, the most heavily Democratic election district or court district in the United States. And so if you look at polling data on what people believe about, quote unquote, Russiagate, Democrats in a vast majority buy into this whole narrative. And so the jury pool, you have a group of people who are in a process that will follow basically wherever the prosecutor leads them, who are already inclined to buy into this thing. And so they didn't require any evidence, and actually none was presented in the indictment to the public. We don't know what was shown to the grand jury, but what they recite as showing to the grand jury doesn't make a case at all. So the thing itself is
nothing. No, but Don, also on top of this, Don, also, is that those Russian nationals will never face trial. They know that there is no extradition treaty between the two countries.
That's the point.
I mean, it was just for display here. Adam, let me go to you, because it was interesting for me in looking at the timeline here.
Because I wanted to say something to that.
Okay. Let me go to Adam. We'll pick it up later.
Peter,
okay?
I just wanted to say something to that. The point essentially is this. If I were running the group in St. Petersburg, if I represented or owned one of those corporate entities, I would have it appear in the process and do a discovery demand. Send, because a corporation can appear by counsel, not the principals. They don't have to come. And have them come and defend it and make them disclose the case. Because the reason that they brought it in the first place is exactly what you said. These are people that will never end up in court. They're not planning on it. So I would go in with the corporation and appear in court and do a discovery demand. Show us your case and then and release it to the public.
They don't want a case. They just wanted a propaganda, score a propaganda point here. You know, Adam, the interesting thing about the timing of the indictments being announced is that it tried to hide the developing scandal, real scandal, that is developing at the DOJ and the FBI. This is another thing they do not want to talk about. There are real facts. There are real documents. We have exchanges between people. We know who they are. We know what they're talking about. That is real. Everything else, I mean, the 17 trolls, I mean, it wasn't even political, you guys. They were just trying to make money, shake some money out of gullible Americans on Facebook and Twitter. I mean, it was a business property. It wasn't politics. Go ahead, Adam.
First of all, in terms of the FBI and the DOJ, what we're seeing now is a bigger scandal than the overtly political impeachment of Andrew Johnson in the 1860s, because at least there it was politicians who were being political, albeit bending some of the rules which they themselves were supposed to abide by. Now we see agencies that are supposed to be apolitical. They're supposed to police things from becoming too political and too biased, and they are acting on behalf of a political party and its party leadership. We have a triangle, a Bermuda Triangle, if you will, between the FBI, the DOJ, the Democratic Party, and it's just become a square because we can add the UK intelligence in terms of this Christopher Steele, a failed UK version of a CIA man, let's put it that way, who then went into writing bogus intelligence, which was really just paid for fiction by the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic Party. And instead of talking about this, which just shows what an oligarchy the United States has tragically become, they're talking about something in Russia, which also happens in India, in Pakistan, throughout East Asia. You can buy ads where people on Twitter or Facebook comment on your posts, like your posts, interact, promulgate the things you're talking about, and it's all perfectly legal. It's also perfectly legal to use a pseudonym online.
Well,
in fact, some
and Adam, and Adam, Adam, before we go to the break here, our viewers have to take this on board. How many other countries around the world and organizations did exactly what that troll farm did? Okay, how many? I bet you we could stay here for hours and name people that bought ads. But that's never mentioned. What about Saudi Arabia? What about Qatar? What about Turkey? What about Israel? It's not mentioned. No, they weren't meddling. They meddle in our elections all the time. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on fake news media.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Let me go back to Charles in New York. Not that I feel sorry for him, but you know what's the situation, and I'm talking about the mainstream media, the corporate mainstream media, is that they're so invested in this story that they can't actually turn back. I mean, this is the problem. They've built up this imaginary world where they're hiding under their beds at night with the light on. I believe that they do believe it's real because of their ideological blindness and hatred. And they've gotten so used to it that it has to somehow succeed. I mean, you look at Rachel Maddow. Do you ever see her going on her program and say, "We were wrong, and I apologize to my viewers"? That ain't going to happen under any circumstances whatsoever. Because say it'll go further and farther up the chain. You know, Louise Mensch, this lunatic. You know, if the New York Times or the Guardian disagrees with her, well, then they're just working for Putin. You know, see, it's gone to the point of madness. Go ahead, Charles.
Well, actually, the real irony here is there's something called, or there was something called the Journalist, which was a list of journalists who all were sort of coordinating message. And I suspect strongly one of the reasons the mainstream is resisting this story and pushing the wrong story is there are a lot of mainstream journalists and family members who likely were paid off out of this $12 million that supposedly the Democrats and Hillary Clinton campaign pushed in. And we don't yet know how much of it came before the election and how much of it came after the election. That is a massive scandal. You should not be able to buy a journalist via a political campaign. I suspect that's unbelievably illegal as well.
Well, let me go to Don. I don't know if it's illegal, but it's certainly immoral, okay? And that it really shows the level of professionalism that exists right now. I mean, this is the greatest irony because Donald Trump was never supposed to win in the minds of these people. And that's why we see so many irregularities, corruption, fraud, all kinds of things, because they never thought they would have to own up to it. I mean, it was just business as usual, rig the Democratic primary, and then try to rig the general. And then you close the circle here. And that's really, they have this cultural hatred for Trump, but they're actually fearing for their lives in many respects, because the level of corruption, the real swamp that they were living in, is being exposed slowly but surely based on facts, not on opinions. And I think that's what we need to stress most. I don't say anything I haven't been able to verify. On CNN and MSNBC, you know, if you slip a little piece of paper under the door and write something, you know, they'll repeat it on air. We already found that out. Go ahead, Don.
Well, first of all, in the music industry, there was a practice known as payola. DJs would basically solicit money from the producers or the artists, you know, musicians. Here's $100, play my record, you know, three times a day or something. And this became widespread practice. And then there were massive criminal prosecutions throughout the industry over this. And this was just over how music gets played on the air. It's not something as fundamental to the operation of a society as the news. And we're talking about something, you know, of an entirely different order when we're talking about what, you know, what we're talking about here, what Charles was referring to. So you have that to consider, first of all. Secondly, today, you know, I've always thought, on the one hand, there's some room in Langley or somewhere where they're cooking all this stuff up and spewing it out from someone having a big picture of the massive public relations effort that's been underway for a couple of years now to take Trump out and to push this Russia thing. And yet, I'm looking at the newsstand today, the New York Times next to the New York Daily News. And in the New York Times, it says essentially Russia bots jumping on the chance to divide the, you know, American public over the shooting in Florida.
Yeah.
They said it in fewer words. On the other hand, right next to it, there's a full page picture in the Daily News of Donald Trump playing golf, saying, "Can I play through?" that says Trump plays golf less than a mile from scene of shooting. In other words, they're doing exactly, in a full-page spot, what they're accusing Russian bots of doing, which is dividing people over the issue of these kids getting murdered in Florida. And I'm wondering, you know, I see this obvious thing on a newsstand, one newspaper next to another, and throughout the New York area, those two papers lie next to each other on a newsstand. But I'm wondering if whoever is doing the little segmented push of, you know, this narrative, if anybody there is actually seeing these things side by side, because those two things are contradictory.
You know, it's very interesting, Adam, you know, looking at the big picture, like what Don was just saying right there. I mean, we had that case a couple of months ago where, you know, the Trump campaign knew of the WikiLeaks dump 10 days before, and then they got the date wrong, right? Okay. And a number of the outlets ran with the story almost simultaneously. And I have to say, and I'm going to be very careful with my words, because I do believe in being responsible as a journalist here. One could easily get the impression that they are singing from the same hymn sheet. They have all this information simultaneously, because if you look at the newscast, they are remarkably similar. Remarkably, even rhetorically, they're very similar here. I mean, this is a concerted effort right now. And then when one makes a mistake, they all make a mistake, and they all make fools of themselves. They destroy their reputation, and they never apologize ever to their viewer. Go ahead, Adam.
You're absolutely right, and it's what in the 50s was called Operation Mockingbird,
right,
where all of the mainstream media outlets were fed certain stories that went with a pro-intelligence agency line. Some of them knew that they were doing the bidding of this oligarchy, and some of them were the useful idiots who actually believed the nonsense and the lies and the mistruths that they were spewing out. And this was, of course, at a time when the U.S. was really good at rigging and hacking elections. We can talk about the illegal removal of the Mossadegh government in Iran, or the removal of the Allende government in Chile in the 1970s. So when it comes to tampering in other people's democracies, I would say that the CIA coups and the occasional military invasions that the U.S. does, let alone Iran-Contra, while they were allies with Saddam, selling money to the Iranians, his enemies, and filtering the profits to the right wing in Nicaragua. And this country is worried about people on Twitter in Russia. You know, 13 people on Twitter.
Okay,
the perspective is necessary.
And their average wage was $1,500 a month, okay? And their primary business was concerned was in Russia, not in the United States. You know, Adam, since you mentioned that, you know, I have a suggestion. Maybe you can think about it. We could do a marathon program of the 81 elections around the world that the U.S. meddled in, up to 2,000. Are you game? That'll be a long program, okay?
Oh, yeah. Okay. And Russia's got an election coming up next month, so that list might have just got longer.
Well, we'll see how that one goes. Charles, you know, one of the interesting things, and I think everybody would at least agree on one thing, is that the United States is a very divided nation right now, more divided than I've ever seen in my life, and it's only getting worse. But the fact that they're peddling this story in the mainstream media is only making it worse, because there are plenty of people like ourselves, rational people. We do have political opinions. But, you know, half of the country is so alienated by this narrative because it has nothing to do with their lives whatsoever. It doesn't mean anything to them. It does to these ideologically driven leftists, Marxist radicals in the media. That means everything. It's their identity. But when it comes to the average rank and file people, the story is alien to them. Even the CNN on an off-the-cuff comment even admitted that. Okay, so if you want to talk about a divided nation, who's dividing it? 17 trolls in St. Petersburg, Russia, or the media? Go ahead, Charles.
I think it's very much the Clinton wing, perhaps supported by the Bush, never Trump wing of the Republican Party. I mean, if you go into hard facts that are on the FBI vault file, which we can assume, I hope, are facts, by February of 2016, early February, the FBI and the State Department had concluded that Hillary Clinton mishandled 2,115 emails out of the 30,490 that she reluctantly turned over December 5th, 2014. I mean, that is a staggering fact, because why didn't Bernie care about the emails? Why didn't the Bernie wing push hard? They could have actually gotten Bernie to be the nominee. And why aren't those people extremely upset with this whole process, not just the Trump supporters? I actually think we're very close in this country to a hopeful moment where people on the left, the Bernie supporters, the people who want change a different way via Trump, are going to look at this mess and say, you know what, it's time for a house cleaning out of CNN, out of the New York Times, out of the Wall Street Journal, out of all these people who are relentlessly focused on a false tale, a damaging false tale that is hurting relations between two great powers, the United States and Russia, for too long. I think this could be a pivotal moment that we're close to.
Don, weigh in on that, because I've often thought that myself here, because I would have liked to have seen Trump go up against Bernie Sanders, because I think there would have been a real national conversation instead of the corporatists determining the narrative and the message and all of that. I mean, you can take your pick. I mean, I think that would have been an honest choice between. I mean, we had two insurgents, grassroots, popular, appealing. And I think that would have really given a shot in the arm of American democracy. But what we have now is we're left with these people. Like I keep saying, Trump was never supposed to be president. And that's why we're seeing all of this corruption. And it's coming from the left. It's coming from liberals. That's where the corruption is here. Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, I would say liberals, not the left. Those two are not
okay.
The same.
I understand that. Okay.
But, and definitely liberals. Yeah. Okay. So look, first of all, you know, when you look at what the phenomenon in 2016, the sociological phenomenon, we were looking at going into it, first of all, people in the streets, Black Lives Matter and all of that, you know, following people in the streets with Occupy and a discussion of class and the 99%, you know, becoming front and center in the society for the first time. Polling data that people don't respect the institutions or look at the institutions as being capable of solving their problems anymore, a lack of legitimacy. Then you see Sanders rise in the Democratic Party as an insurgent, as you said, riding on the back of exactly that. The Democratic Party institutions, the Clintons, all of that, lacking legitimacy. Trump, exactly the same. He's an outsider. Instead of Bush, the insider, and Cruz and Rubio, all the insiders, the whole lot of them were rejected by Republican voters.
Don, I have to jump in here. We've run out of time. Fascinating talking to all of you. Many thanks to my guests in New York and in London. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.